Good to be with you all once again as we continue in worship to our God. We had been doing a series on Ephesians 4. We still will finish that, but this week I thought we'd take a little break on that. We'll study something else. We'll return back to that, Lord willing, next week, and we'll wrap it up second week of February. It would have been the first week, but I'm out of town that first Sunday. I'll be in Tampa. But we will finish that series. Tonight, though, we're going to be looking at three sections or three texts from the Gospel of Luke that really teach us three things or a couple lessons about what is required to come near to God or to approach God. We could start off by starting thinking about what does a Roman centurion, a tax collector, and a blind man have in common? And no, this is not a setup to a bad joke. These are the three texts that we're going to be looking at from this gospel. So jumping right into it then, we're going to be in Luke chapter 7 to begin with, looking at the centurion and his servant. In Luke 7, verses 1 through 10, as you're turning over there, this event takes place right after Luke's account of the Sermon on the Mount. And I believe it's one of those providential events that happened in the life of Christ here that illustrates an overall point that Christ was making on the sermon. A point that we will be studying more in detail, Lord willing, next Sunday morning when we look at the Beatitudes. But in Luke chapter 7, starting in verse 1. Now when he concluded all his sayings, in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. And a certain centurion's servant, who was dear to him, was sick and ready to die. So when he heard about Jesus, he sent elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him, come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying that he was one whom he should do this was deserving. For he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. Then Jesus went with them. And when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I'm not worthy that you enter under my roof. Therefore, I do not even think myself worthy to come to you, but say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him and turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. And those who were sent, returning to his house, to the house, found the servant well who had been sick. So to begin with tonight, we're going to be looking at, as we just read, the account here of the centurion's servant being healed. It is amazing that in Luke's gospel, at least one of these, this healing in particular, that in Luke, Matthew, and Mark, Christ has the same response to the man's statement about, I am one under authority and people under me. If I say jump, people ask how high and they do it. Is that we have God in the flesh marveling at the faith of man. Because in his preaching thus far, as he said in the text, he had not yet found faith like that in all of Israel. These are supposed to be the people of God. And yet the centurion has the understanding of just like, no, Lord, you don't even need to come to me. Simply say the word and it will be done. But let's look back at the events of the healing here. So to begin with, this man, the centurion, a veteran of the legion, would have had some considerable wealth. He is stationed on the remotest parts of the empire. Caesarea at this time was pretty much as far east you could go and be underneath Roman protection. It was a garrison city. And so it had this, he was an officer of the legion stationed there. And he sends Jewish elders. We might infer so as not to give offense to Jesus being a Jew, not to associate with a Gentile. But he sends them. He sends them to plead the case, come and heal my servant. But I want us to know how the elders pleaded the case. They begged with Jesus earnestly, verses 4 through 5, saying that this is one whom you should do this, because he was deserving. The Jewish elders come to Jesus and say, you kind of owe it to this guy because, well, he's worthy of this miracle to be put on, to be performed for. Not only is he deserving, well, here's why he's deserving. He loves our nation. Here's a Roman that loves the Jews. Who ever heard of such a thing? And not only that, he built us this new synagogue in town. Surely you need to heal the guy. The guy's servant. He's worthy. When in fact, as our brother Paul prayed this evening, none of us are. And that's the thing. The Jewish elders here think that they can plead this man's case by stating all the good things he's done for the people. What's interesting when you look at when the servant or the friends, depending on your translation, is sent to them, these men may have been more faithful messengers than the Jewish elders in that they're conveying the actual feeling or the words that the centurion one have said. Again, look back in verse 6 and 7. It says, then Jesus went with them, and he was already not far away from the house. The centurion sent friends to him, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof. Therefore, I didn't even think myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. I didn't intend for this lesson to tie so well with this morning, but here you see again faith in action. Here's a man who has heard enough about Jesus to form a right opinion and understanding of what this man is capable of, what he can do for him and his servant. He says, I know who you are. I know you are God in the flesh. And I'm not worthy to come to you. So just simply say the word and my servant will be healed. I'll know it will be done. The lesson from this first one, as we haven't already stated, is the fact that none of us are worthy to approach God on our own. It's by God's grace and His provision that we are able to even approach Him. We only can approach Him based on the work that somebody else has done and us accepting that and the conditions to receive that. In a very real sense, this story here of this event illustrates the first beatitude. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. As we talk about the overview of the Sermon on the Mount, that those who do not recognize their total spiritual bankruptcy without God, they can by no means enter the kingdom. And here you have a man here who recognizes that he's not worthy to even come near Jesus. That's the truth. But God, Jesus shows grace upon grace, and that not only does he come to him, he commends his faith, and he heals his servant. This is the first and most fundamental fact that we need to get straight and understand if we're going to even come near God to worship him or to be saved by him. The next text we're going to be looking at is found in Luke, the 18th chapter, verses 9 through 14. The Pharisee and the tax collector. Luke, the 18th chapter, starting in verse 9. Now, this one is a parable, but because it seems to me that Jesus, he's very specific with, well, it's very consistent with what Jesus already condemned about the Pharisees and what we already know about the Pharisees. It may be one of those parables that had more, was rooted more in fact than fiction. But we see here, starting in verse 9, and we'll read through verse 14. And also he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extorters, unjust, adulterers, and even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. This parable, as we're told, Jesus spoke it, directly targeting those who were trusting in the fact that they were righteous and despised others. Right, thought themselves righteous and despised others. And we're given these two men, the Pharisee, who Jesus had no short list of things against the Pharisees to talk about, no shortage of faults and misapplications and practices that they were engaged in, and a tax collector. Notice there's a theme so far that the quote good guys in the stories, if you want to use that terminology, so far have been people that historically were hated by the Jews. The centurion was a man who represented the Rome's occupying force in Judea and Samaria. The centurion represented the Roman state, the literal power of the sword over life and death. And even though the centurion man loved the Jewish people, if the Jews were to revolt, he would be one in charge of putting down the revolt. And here you have a tax collector, another representation, a representative of Roman power and people who were despised in first century Israel. Here's a man who his very job involves extortion, bribery, and lining your own pockets. How taxes work in the ancient world, at least in this time, you had rich Romans, often bid, like eBay, on a tax contract of the right to levy, to collect taxes from a certain region. So it'd be like if our representatives every year, every April or so, went to the state house and decided to bid on how much they were willing to pay to collect taxes from Tucson. And the thing was, they had to front the money. So say you, and say one of our representatives said, I'll pay $500,000. That's probably way too low to collect taxes from Tucson. They would then have the right exclusively to collect taxes from Tucson, and it was expected that not only would they recoup their losses, but you got to get paid for the job you're doing. So it was expected that they would take even more than what they had bid. And even then, it was expected on top of that, you line your pockets. Now, you can't do that all by yourself, so you go out because you have the money to buy a tax contract, and hire other locals to do the bidding for you. So, when we encounter Matthew, for example, in the Gospels, and this tax collector here, they're just a local from the province trying to make a living, and somebody came along and says, I'll pay you to collect taxes. And you can collect a little extra to line your own pockets. But they represent the authority of Rome and extortion and bribery and all these other things, but yet he's the hero of the story. It's the Pharisee who's the villain. I mean, we don't have to think far to identify somebody like a Pharisee in this parable. That he's not really praying to God, he's praying to himself. And he's using the language of God to veil that. Think about this. They're both going to the temple to pray about this. So imagine us coming in here tonight to pray, and I'm going to get up and lead the opening prayer, and I'm going to say, Lord, I thank you that I'm not like the people here tonight. I'm not a swindler. I'm not a tax collector. I'm not like Brett in the back. That's the kind of stuff we're talking about. And meanwhile, tax collector, who probably can hear this guy, thanking God he's not like this guy over here, he won't even bother to look up to heaven. He's beating himself, beating his breast, which is an ancient sign of mourning and grief. He's praying the only thing really a person can pray to God. Be merciful to me, for I am a sinner. And Jesus said the lesson from this parable is that that man, he went away justified. And not the first guy. Not the guy who pays tithes of all that he has. He fasts twice a week. It doesn't matter about the righteous deed you've done. Or deeds, for that matter. What is the heart? How are you approaching God? And so again, Jesus says everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. That is a humbling statement. You get too big for your britches, you get too prideful, don't be surprised if God, well, takes you out the knees to bring you down a few levels. One of the shepherds where I grew up, he freely admits this and he publicly preached on it. He said, my wife and I, when we owned our own futon business, we were living pretty high. We had a boat, we had a really nice house, we were living, and we got a little bit too big for our britches and too prideful. And lo and behold, in a 3-month period, we'd lost most of everything. He said, I'm glad that happened. We got thinking we didn't need God. And we were brought low. So the lesson from this one is that, yes, we need to recognize our spiritual condition before God, as we learned in the centurion. But in this one, we learned that God desires the humble heart to come before Him, not the prideful heart. It's what Jesus Himself said in the Gospels, that it's, you know, the Pharisees and scribes were sneering at the fact that He was eating with sinners and prostitutes and tax collectors. And Jesus responds simply back with, it's not the righteous, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, it's the sick. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Play on word, the reality of that is those who thought they were righteous were actually the sinners. All of them were. But you look in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 5 through 7, Peter writes down this principle about our humility before God. 1 Peter chapter 5, starting in verse 5, I'll read through verse 7. He says, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you be in submission to one another and be clothed with humility. That's the key point here of the text. For God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves underneath the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon Him, for He cares for you. I don't know for sure, but it sure seems that Peter had this text in mind when he was writing this, because it reads similar to what Jesus says, everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. God has no room for prideful, self-righteous individuals. He has room for the humble and contrite in heart. I think there's a principle here also, it's not on the board, but there's a principle taught from Psalm 51, verses 16 and through 17. Psalm 51, verses 16 through 17. Again, the 51st Psalm, verses 16 through 17. This psalm is David's prayer to God, repenting of the sin with Bathsheba. Interesting enough, if I understand the time is correct, David, this is a whole year after the incident, before David prays this prayer, or pins it down at least. And he says here about what God actually desires from people. You do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. I suggest to you that verses 16 and 17 give us a mere image of this parable. God is not desiring that this Pharisee come before Him to list his righteous deeds. He's desiring that the attitude of the tax collector. Somebody come to Him with a broken and contrite heart. One who knows his condition and is seeking restitution restitution of relationship with God. And thirdly, tonight we want to look again back at Luke 18. We're going to still be in the same chapter, but now looking at verses 35 through 43. A blind Bartimaeus. Again, Luke 18, starting in verse 35. Read to verse 43. Then it happened, as he was coming near Jericho, a certain blind man sat by the road begging. And hearing a multitude passing by, he asked what it meant. So they told him that Jesus of Nazareth was passing by. And he cried out, saying, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Then those who went before warned him that he should be quiet. But he cried out all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. So Jesus stood still and commanded him be brought to him. And when he had come near, he asked him, saying, what do you want me to do for you? He said, Lord, that I may receive my sight. Then Jesus said to him, "Receive your sight. Your faith has made you well." And immediately he received his sight and he followed him, glorifying God. And all the people, when they saw it, gave praises to God. This is taking place right before Jesus enters Jerusalem for the last Passover and the week leading up to his crucifixion. It's near Jericho, and this man, as was common with those infirmed or with disabilities, had no other means of living than simply to beg for alms or charitable gifts. And this man is doing as such. He hears a commotion, obviously, because by this point the crowds are massive that follow Jesus, no matter where he goes. He hears the commotion, so he asks simply, "What's going on?" Again, he's completely at the will of everyone else to find out anything that is happening near him. And they told him that Jesus is coming. Jesus of Nazareth is coming. By this point, Christ has been preaching for almost 3 years, a little over that probably. Word has traveled far and near, especially in the region of Jerusalem. And so this man would have probably picked up tidbits here and there of people passing by the road, speaking of a miracle they saw or a teaching or whatever it may be. He had knowledge. He definitely had knowledge of who Jesus was. So he cries out. And I think sometimes when it comes to our Bible translations, because they're trying to be accurate, word for word, at least most of them are trying to be, that sometimes they pick words that don't have the same thrust that the originals did. I don't know about you, but sometimes I read out, cry out, and I kind of just read over that and gloss over that. Literally, there in that text, he's exclaiming. He's yelling, "Son of David, have mercy on me." This is a man who is desperate for help. And when they tell him to shut up, be quiet, don't bother Jesus, he yells out even louder. "Have mercy on me. Come near to me." This is all he can do. He's not going to let the crowd stop him. He's not going to let anybody tell him to be quiet. He's going to keep on yelling and keep on pleading that Christ come near to him. And Jesus hears the cry. Again, both times his cry is, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." That's a whole statement worthy of a sermon in itself, but that's rich in understanding of who Jesus of Nazareth was and is. And he's praying for the only thing that we can pray for. He's praying for the thing that the tax collector was praying for. He was praying for the thing that the centurion in spirit was asking for, mercy. And so he asks, Jesus come near and asks, "What do you want me to do for you?" And I think the language is telling in that he asks to receive his sight. He's not demanding anything. He's not saying, "I'm worthy of this." He's not saying, "I deserve this." He's not bragging about his self-righteous deeds, far from it. He's very much asking, "Lord, if you're willing, I'd like to receive back." Receive, to me, carries the idea of receiving a gift. You didn't earn it, couldn't do anything for it. It's simply by the grace of Christ that's going to do this. And so he receives his sight. He's immediately healed, he praises God, and he follows Jesus. I believe the lesson from this one about who may approach God, who may come near to God, is those who will stop at nothing to come to Him. As we read this morning in Hebrews 11 and verse 6, "But without faith it is impossible to please Him, for he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him." I haven't been doing this very long. I've done it long enough where I've come across individuals that, I mean, you really just, they come to you and they set up the study with you, even though they're the ones that need the study. You know, for example, we had one individual who, and we connected with the meetup group, and very superficial conversation the first time, and then they show up here at the building for services, and after services, before I can say hi, it's like, "I have questions. When can you meet up and study?" I'm like, okay. And we wrestled with some hard things. We wrestled with some of the more difficult passages in Deuteronomy about laws regarding the violation of certain ethical norms there. We we wrestled with roles of men and women in the church and some other things that our culture does not seem to be too keen on. And throughout all of it, the consistent attitude is, what is the will of God? How do I get close to God? Didn't matter what they had to go through, didn't matter how many obstacles, they were going to find where God was at and how they could approach them. They were one who diligently sought God. So let's try to compare these three texts here from this evening. We actually learned two sets of lessons. We learned a set of lessons about who may not approach God. And what we've seen from the bad guys in each of these stories, if you want to use that phrase, it's not those who believe themselves worthy. That was the Jewish elder's estimation of the centurion. Yeah, Jesus, you ought to do this. I mean, he's deserving. He built us a new synagogue. Come on. Like, what don't you get? New synagogue, heal the guy's servant. It's not the self-righteous, like the Pharisee. God has no room for the self-righteous. I would even jot down Ecclesiastes 5, the first three verses there, about more on that. It's definitely also not those who would not permit another to come. In blind Bartimaeus, that crowd's in the wrong in that they're trying to prevent somebody else to come to Christ. And may I suggest to you that one of the reasons why many of the Lord's people, many of the flocks of the Lord's people are dying is because they have epitomized this attitude. Many don't want our little club to be messed up. Very godly man, very good preacher, told of a story one time where they were visiting a congregation, and believe it or not, they sat down, it was open pew and everything, and shortly before services started, they got the tap on the shoulder. You're in our spot. Could you move? And they kind of just look at disbelief of just, did just that just happen? And they said, thankfully we weren't non-believers and we could take it in stride, but I mean, imagine that. And I cited this a couple of weeks ago, but a recent article about growing churches, about what evangelism looks like, growing churches embrace the messiness that comes with new converts and children and families and recovering Christians, all of it. Christianity is not a nice, neat, tight little country club. No pun intended. It is messy. It is relational. It looks like a whole bunch of people falling apart at the seams, banding together to do the work that God has called us to do. And these attitudes here, one or all of them, one's awful. All of them is horrible. Will hinder and kill your own faith and possibly hinder and kill somebody else's and a congregation. But we also learn in this, as the main point of the lesson is, those who come near to God are those who know their condition. Blind Bartimaeus, the centurion, the tax collector, they all knew themselves. I'm a Gentile. I'm part of the legion. I have no right to be here. Jesus is. I have no right to even have Jesus in my own home. You know, the tax collector says, "Lord, have mercy upon me. I'm a sinner." And blind Bartimaeus knew he was totally and utterly dependent upon everyone else for everything. He had to be brought to Jesus. He couldn't go to Jesus by himself. He had to be brought, finally, at Jesus' command. It's those who seek God in humility. All three of these stories, the centurion shows great humility. Same with the tax collector and blind Bartimaeus. He's not seeking audience with Jesus, blind Bartimaeus, to simply prove himself or make a point. He's seeking him because he knows he is the only one that can possibly even be the solution for my answer. And I believe that Bartimaeus would have almost none of that wishy-washy maybe language there. He would be absolutely assured. And finally, it's those who will stop at nothing to come to him. As we talked about. So who may approach God? It's those who are poor in spirit. as we're going to be talking about next week. And you know, the great thing is about us being in Christ. Thanks to Christ's work on the cross, thanks to Him purchasing the way, opening the gates to heaven, however you want to phrase it, whatever biblical language you want to use, we have to possess these traits before we even become Christians. You don't become a Christian and be full of spiritual self-righteousness. It takes first a recognition of your own sins and a remorseful mourning over those sins, being poor in spirit in order to enter the kingdom of God. But once you're in that kingdom, you have boldness to come before God's throne. In Hebrews, the 10th chapter, starting in verse 19. In Hebrews chapter 10, starting in verse 19, we'll read through 22. The Hebrew writer says, "Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which He consecrated for us through the veil, that is His flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart or a pure heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water." Once we have come to God and accept the gospel, we have boldness, we have confidence, we have a surety to approach God's throne anytime, day or night, because of Christ's blood having cleansed us and made us right before Him. I look out tonight and I see that all of us have, to my knowledge, obeyed the gospel. And so maybe use your notes, maybe talk to somebody this week about how do you approach God, how do you get right with God, how to have saving faith. But if you're here tonight and perhaps you're struggling and you have sin in your life that needs confessing, or you're struggling with your walk and need prayers of strength and encouragement, now's not the only time, but now's a good time to get that strength and encouragement so you can go into this week right with the Lord. If you have a need, please, won't you come? Does everybody stand to sing the song that's been selected?